Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 23rd, 2001. In the Creekside Room this afternoon is a forum titled Globalization and You. The session number is 2001-15 with Mike Shute as a presenter. Let's listen in.
We just made it up today.
Yeah.
Nikes, immigrants, and
Stills.
Oh my. So, partly following on, my name is Mike Scott. I work with Earth Ministry in Seattle. Stuff back there about Earth Ministry, and you could be on our mailing list if you'd like to. Feel free to pick any of that stuff up back there. We work with churches and congregations, and individuals on the connections between Christian faith and caring for the earth, and both practical programs and sort of worldview and theology behind that. And I just talked with Dan, the program coordinator, who just came in this morning about kind of shifting the focus of this session slightly based on a number of conversations I had with people after Tuesday's session when we didn't have, there was just a lot being raised, and anytime you're talking about globalization, there's too much to talk about and too much to understand, really, in a short amount of time or even perhaps in a lifetime. But at least this will give us a chance to go into it for a little bit longer as well. We can go until 6:15 if we want to. There's some seats up here if you want to.
Okay.
Let's see. Oh, also, much of what I've been sort of teaching out of, partly this week, has been out of this book, Simple Living, Compassionate Life. And it's a book that Earth Ministry self-published, published, co-published with the Morehouse Group. And there are some copies left in the bookstore. If you'd like to purchase one, there are not that many left. If they run out up there, are these little postcards on the back table. It has an 800 number on the back if you want to actually order one. And you could look at my copy if you wanted to, if they run out up there. So, to begin with, I thought it would be, who hasn't been to any sessions yet of mine? Okay, so a good number, so I won't assume much in terms of shared conversations earlier in the week. I'm not assuming you don't know anything. but to begin with, I thought it would be, I think it's some very important that we have a bit of a historical framework for thinking about quote unquote globalization. I think it's easy to see or believe that where we are now is just where we are and it's inevitable. And there, as opposed to seeing that there have been decisions and processes that have led up to where we are, and then indeed they're not inevitable. And that will help, I think, take some of the mystery and power away from that term and the process that has led us to where we are today. I've talked, just as people came in, with a couple folks about, I may call on them to give a little perspective from their own personal life about how globalization has either influenced their business or their life, or how their perspective may have changed on it over the years. And then one thing we might do is just brainstorm some of the pros and cons we feel globalization brings to us in our culture, let's say, and with a worldwide perspective as well. And then just see where we go. A couple of ground rules that please recognize that everyone has a chance to speak if they want to, not sort of when we have the open discussion, I'll try and monitor this, but not to rule the floor, so to speak, or dominate the floor, and that there will be differing opinions on this stuff, and that's, as it said in a little advertisement for this, differing opinions are welcome and needed here. So let's just respect one another's life histories that have brought us to where we are at this point in terms of our perspectives on this. But for those of you who haven't, on Monday and Tuesday especially, in some ways we set some perspectives that I think are behind what I'll be talking about, at least, that I want to at least get out there, and that is that there's a theology and a worldview behind my perspective that values creation, all of creation, human and non-human creation, and sees a Christian worldview as supporting that, and that there are a few that Christians believe that the earth is the Lord's. That's from the Psalms. The earth is the Lord's and all that is therein, and that to degrade it is evil. That's a perspective or is not right, at least, if you don't for evil. And that's partly coming from John Cobb, to an article in the book that we have, Simple Living, Compassionate Life. Second, that the consumption of goods and services is less important than our relationships with one another, that a Christian worldview would affirm that. And that, as we go into a discussion today, we might uncover the fact that our economy does not actually practice that, that it emphasizes consumption of goods and services above and beyond our relationships with one another, and that the current economy sees us primarily as individuals in a market, as opposed to people created to be in community. Individuals in a market as opposed to people created to be in community. And another, underneath the word community is non-human community as well. So just when you hear community, when you hear earth, when you hear creation, I'm including both human and non-human as part of that. And it's interesting that I have to even say that. It shows that we have significant splits in our perceptions. And when we say the word nature, we think it's not us. But that's not where we're operating from today. So any questions about today, where we're going, ground rules, and
Well, I'm just going to make a comment on the Christian perspective. It depends on your perspective on what the Christian perspective is. I mean, I would agree with you, but there's lots of people that I know that claim they're Christian and they don't have that perspective at all.
That's why I'm saying my Christian perspective, and maybe I should have said mine. And that's the bias I'm bringing to this. And that if there are questions that come up about that during the session, particularly like if you're wanting to go back and talk with some of these people, maybe there's some things we could talk about that would help frame your discussion with them, for example. Did you have a... No? Okay. Thank you, Bill. That's exactly right. anything else? Okay. Feel free to interject as we go along. So let's start here with John Cobb is a process theologian at Fairmont School of Theology, but also since 1969, when his son sort of, as he puts it, converted him to what was happening on the natural world, has looked. Spent a lot of time looking at the juncture of ecology and economics and looking at it from a theologian's perspective. We had him, we had a lecture series of Earth Ministry sponsored, and he was one of our presenters. And I'm taking this look at history from him. So John Cobb, and his presentation lasted 45 minutes and was stunning. And this will be like a 10-minute overview. This probably won't be stunning. it's really good stuff. And his question is, what, as we look at history over time, what is a culture's dominant religion? And this, in this case, Western culture's dominant religion. So this will be kind of a 1,500-year look at history, and then we'll go to a 50-year look over here. But so first he said Christianism, and again, that not being a relationship with Christ or God or a faith, but actually the religious expression of a faith, the religiosity that Christianism was, you know, perhaps since the time that the Catholic religion became the state religion up until about the 1600s, that Christianism was the dominant cultural religion of the day. And so you see that expressed in, of course, the Crusades, or in the wars between, eventually in the 1500s, I suppose, between Catholics and Protestants. So there's a lot of killing going on about the form of faith that a person or a group has. And he says that that shifted in the Treaty of Westphalia, which said that, okay, let's stop this killing amongst Christians. This doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, I don't know what they said, but that might have been one of the things. But let's let the princes of a country, of a nation state, decide. Let's let the leaders decide, and then we'll kind of try and stop killing each other over it, and the country can decide. And so he says that that's when the nation state began to gain preeminence over the Christianism, the expression of religion within a country or within a culture. And again, and he recognizes that there's still nationalism alive, there's still Christianism alive, but it is true that there have been certain shifts, and it's helpful to have some kind of historic framework for thinking about when those shifts happened. Nationalism, we perhaps could suggest that its most horrific form came about in World War II. The nation states of the world battling each other, and at the end of World War II, the victors came together to create institutions to perhaps encourage or discourage another World War from happening. And the institutions that, many of the institutions that they created were around economic relationships between nation states. So we have, for example, Bretton Woods, which turned into World Bank, and out of that eventually the IMF, International Monetary Fund. So he says that perhaps we could look at 1945 as the end of nationalism, or at least the beginning of economism. The culture's dominant cultural religion or idol being economism. And I think it's pretty clear how that is still primarily the case. It's hard for a politician to get elected in challenging economic growth, for example, or even suggesting that perhaps there's another way of structuring our economy that would be better for us, for the community in the long run. Nader tried to do that a bit in his campaign, but didn't do so well. And it's true of Democrats and Republicans both. You can't challenge the god of economic growth. Then, and you notice how the time frame gets shorter between them. Things are changing much more quickly now. And Cobb points to, hopefully, I think, says that the only movement or belief system, if you will, that he sees as possible that could challenge the preeminence of economism is Earthism. And he points to Earth Day, the first Earth Day, I think, 1972, I believe. As an example, there are now some professors or programs in the institution of a university, for example, that would be willing to suggest that maybe economic growth, as we understand it in our economic system, is not the end-all and be-all, and that there are certain, you know, programs that emphasize that, students coming out suggesting that, and conferences around those issues, right? And we all know about that happening a bit. We hear about in the papers. The reality of Earth degradation is much more part of our common language. So Earthism is having an influence, I think I would say, but that economism is still the predominant cultural religion in America today. And Cobb, one of the best things about John Cobb, if you want to, I really recommend reading him, is that he's so good at acknowledging the good in these various things. The good in Christianism, the good in nationalism, the good in economism. And we can maybe talk more about that later when we talk about pros and cons of globalization, perhaps. So he's able to lay out there, because he's so smart and thoroughly grounded in economics as well as theology, to speak the language of the economists and the powers that be, but then and acknowledge what's good about them, and then say, but here are the limitations. And so he critiques all of these as well, and of course, as a Christian, he does so. And one of the critiques of Kurtism is that as Christians, we don't believe that the earth is God, for example. And he gives the perhaps fanciful example in his talk that if, for example, life was found on another planet and we did think that the earth was God, we were somehow, our spirituality, again, equate the two, that then God's care and love wouldn't apply to that other part of creation. So he's not suggesting that we, I think he's suggesting we become earthists, but Christian earthists, but that the direction that earthists are going is the direction to go, because they are the ones that are challenging this, the God of economic growth, and living into the, what I would say is also a Christian worldview, the sanctity of all creation. But at the same time, critiquing them for their sort of equation of potentially with earth equaling God. Mm-hmm. So, again, he would point out that all each of these is still alive and that we're in transition. But again, that these are some helpful points in history to keep in mind. And so when we talk about globalization, we're obviously going to be talking about what's sort of been happening since economism began to become more and more preeminent. Are there any comments on that? Yeah.
It's important, I think, to note that these are this is a Western model we're looking at here, I think, aren't we? Up to the point where it becomes economism.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And not necessarily so, because it depends on the impact that economism has had on another culture at a certain point in history. Because there certainly are still other ways of organizing an economy that are still existent, but more and more of them are being plowed under in light of economism's strength. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Japan was a nationalistic country.
True.
There are other places in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Any other comments before we go on to another look at history briefly? Okay, this next one is, we'll look specifically at one of the institutions that was created out of this, out of economism, that is the Global Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, or GATT. And there have been about, I think, 6 or 7 rounds of GATT, times when the signing countries, signatory countries, come together and revamp and say, well, how do we want to change that? How's it going? That sort of thing. The 7th round, I think it was 7th, in 1988 to 1992, they take a while. It was called the Uruguay round. You might remember that back in the early 90s, a fair amount of coverage on that. And But first, just, it's interesting to point out, if you look at, like, the vote, when GATT first came out as, you know, as part of what, of how countries would relate to one another, there were significant points in our nation's history where the Senate, for example, would not pass elements of GATT. And the reasons are very interesting in that they would not allow the U.S. to control its own destiny, in a sense. So nationalism, perhaps we could say nationalism was rearing its head again, but also concerning, the Senate was concerned that our own national sovereignty would be overruled by this body, the GATT, the set of agreements that didn't reflect U.S. interests. So that'll be interesting to see that now, it's interesting to see that now you don't hear that anymore. What you hear is Bush and Clinton and so on asking for fast-track authority to pass these sort of global trade agreements, not the Congress saying, well, is this even a good idea? At least that's much more of a minority perspective now.
But it actually was in the arguments against NAFTA, mm-hmm. in which there was an alliance, an interesting alliance between the far right and the far left.
Yeah.
The far right actually voiced that particular argument, which was that by entering into NAFTA, we were going to give up sovereignty because there would be an exterior resolution to conflicts between nations.
And yeah.
That was, it wasn't so voiced.
So, we heard it, but it didn't carry the day.
It certainly didn't. Yeah.
Didn't carry the day.
Could you give us some notion? I don't recall who all is involved in GATT. I mean, it says global agreement, but is it kind of the UN, similar to the UN
it's membership? Actually, I don't know how many signatory countries there are now, but it's like 160. It's almost everybody.
Okay.
You know,
including the less developed countries.
Yes.
And so forth.
Yes. Yeah, it's not just the UN, for example.
Okay. I'm confusing it with like the G8 now or the G7.
Right. So there is that historical perspective, I think that's interesting. And we can see a significant shift in our national discussion, at least in the national result of our willingness to go to vote for these things in the Senate at the national level. Now, the interesting thing about the Uruguay round that was particularly of concern to environmentalists and I think labor groups as well, was that prior to the Uruguay round, GATT was primarily geared toward addressing tariffs. I just looked this up earlier. Tariff is a system of duties or taxes imposed by a government on import or export of goods. And prior to the Uruguay round, things like insurance or banking services were not part of the GATT, of the agreements around GATT. But corporations and those with a lot of power during the 80s pushed governments to say, let's look at non-tariff barriers to trade. So a banking service, for example, could be a non-tariff barrier to trade. For example, and I've taken this from Chi Yok Ling, who's president of Friends of the Earth in Malaysia. And in 1991, she addressed this gathering of leading environmentalists in the US. I saw a tape of it in grad school, thought it was so good that I got a copy and I still show it. And it's talked about in the book. There's a place you can call to get a copy of that video. But I think it's really important to hear people like a woman from a third world country talking about her country's perspective on global agreements on trade, because mainly we hear our country's lines and perspectives. So one example of this would be that now under GATT, the Uruguay round of GATT, a company could come in to Malaysia, in this case, her country, and prior to that round, there would be certain restrictions on the profits related to that company's work. So there would, let's say, be a law that would say 30% of your profit, you know, whatever the country is, Monsanto or ABM, has to stay in this country. Or 30% of your shares, your stocks, have to be owned by Malaysian people. Or certain regulations so that a country, a small country, could have at least a little bit more control over a corporation that is there. Those are the kinds of things that were attached, so to speak, or addressed in a new way under GATT and the other way around. Other examples are things like environmental regulations. Again, these are non-tariffs, right? They're a law of a country. So the U.S. has a good law, let's say, around using dolphin-safe nets to catch tuna. And Mexico doesn't. The U.S. says to Mexico, we won't take your tuna because you're using nets that kill dolphins. And this is an actual case. Mexico challenged that ruling and won, saying that the U.S. law not allowing us to import Mexican tuna was a barrier to trade. So that, because Mexican fishers obviously would like to sell their tuna here. So it opened up the U.S. market to Mexican tuna. Mexican caught tuna. So those are examples of non-tariff barriers to trade that the GATT in 1992, the Uruguay Round, addressed and included within the agreements. And GATT passed and became the WTO. That's actually, WTO is the World Trade Organization. And the World Trade Organization, of course, we now know thanks to Seattle, right? And so the network of people that protested the WTO was quite diverse. As most of you know, it included human rights groups, it included environmentalists, labor groups, and so on. So, go ahead, yeah.
You said it was challenged in what setting?
Yeah, well, see, that's a really good question. The governing body of GATT is in Geneva, or at least the WTO governing body is in Geneva. And I don't know well enough the machinations of GATT and WTO, but essentially there is a body, a ruling body in Geneva, and representatives from both groups go to Geneva and present their cases. And I've known a little bit more about it, and it's just fuzzy for me, so I can't say well enough how that process is determined. But I think it's instructive to remember that what's the purpose of the WTO? I mean, that's the group that's, I mean, the purpose of the WTO isn't to, let's say, serve the well-being of human and non-human communities. The purpose of the WTO is to increase trade and to allow trade to be quote-unquote free. And that's our economic system, of course, and because of the way we perceive our economic system, free trade is sort of the end goal of our economic system. From a Chio Kling's perspective, a Malaysian woman's perspective, speaking from her country's point of view, it's impossible to have free trade when you have America trading with Malaysia. And she likens it to Carl Lewis and Ben Johnson. This was when they were still running. So Carl Lewis and Ben Johnson, 100-meter race, you know, the rules are fair, and it's a fair race. It's a free race. But she likened it to Carl Lewis running against an impoverished Malaysian peasant or African worker or, and it's, that was her, that's her perspective. And I think it's worth hearing that perspective. And we have a couple of comments.
Oh, I was just going to say, in terms of the process, the information that I've read says that basically the way the process goes is that there are 5 men in Geneva who basically decide these things behind closed doors without any oversight or even any reporting in terms of how they did it, and that there's no need for them to, like we think of a court where you issue why your judgment was what it was based on. There's no need for them to issue any basis for their judgment. They just go back there, make their decision, announce it, finished. And so it's not at all in the way we look at a democratic process for doing any decision.
And I don't know the specifics as well as that, but I do know the general comment is very true, that it's a non-democratic process, that that's one of the main criticisms of how the WTO makes its decisions and is set up. Mm-hmm. And again, it's an example of, I mean, we, the people, vote in environmental regulations, right? I mean, eventually that's, we have an influence on how the United States is going to enact its laws. But that's, the concern is that that's not the case when you have a body like the WTO, in a sense, creating laws that we have no opportunity to vote on. Mm-hmm. So, someone else had their hand up, I think. Oh, yeah, Dan?
Just following up on that Malaysian example, what is the situation now in terms of profit margins and stock percentage of stockholders, that kind of thing.
In that specific example?
Or developing countries, however.
I don't know, except to say that her presentation was prior to GATT even being passed. And her point was that if the GATT passes, those regulations could be challenged as barriers to trade. So I'm presuming that, but so I don't know what the new percentages are, or even if there are percentages. And again, GATT has become the WTO, so now if a country is working with Malaysia and they wanted to challenge certain parts of Malaysia's laws, they would do so under WTO. But I don't know the specific story there. Okay. Thanks.
I was going to say, those percentages, were those laws that were written by Malaysia, or was there some treaty prior to that was sort of like universal?
That's a good question. It wouldn't necessarily be universal. I mean, it would be, although it may have been eventually created under a part of GATT before this round, for example, and I don't know if it was, if each country had their own regulations in that regard, or if those were already underneath GATT. Mm-hmm. My assumption is they weren't under GATT because non-tariff barriers to trade weren't part of GATT before that. Mm-hmm. So that each country, you know, well, okay, this global economy is tough, but we can still have some laws here that will help protect our economy and our country, mm-hmm. and we'll do so by saying, okay, you can do business with us, but whatever percentage of the profits have to stay here. Mm-hmm. I imagine each country did that separately from GATT, because GATT didn't have the barriers as part of what it included at that time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, I don't know the specifics, but I know some European countries have challenged some of GATT's rules regarding their specific health effects on their populations, and have won. Not had to follow GATT's agreements on free trade because they said this product is going to harm the health of our population.
Yeah.
Therefore, we don't have to do that.
That's true. A country, or like the European Union, can not agree to follow WTO's rules, but it then allows, like there have been these kind of wars between the U.S. and the European Union over some of these issues. If the European Union does not agree to abide by WTO rules, the U.S. is then allowed to, in a sense, retaliate in certain trade wars, or let's say, imposing really high tariffs on French cheese or, you know, British burgers or whatever it might be. Not bad to impose it there, British burgers, actually. So that's a good point. It's not like the WTO has final say. However, the penalties, the potential penalties for not following WTO's rulings are quite high, or they're powerful retaliatory measures that the country like the U.S. can impose.
I mean, it seemed like an important historical perspective for us to go before there was GATT and talk about what the economic situation was with different countries.
Before GATT,
and why GATT came into being. I mean, my understanding is there was a huge patchwork quilt, and every country had their own regulations and huge tariffs on things that they had industries for, and it was very difficult for anyone to export or import because of the, you know, complexity of the regulation, which is why GATT formed. And so a small country such as the one this woman came from, Malaysia, was it, you know, may not have been able to get textiles into the U.S. because the U.S. textile industry was protecting itself by having huge tariffs on everything that came in.
Yeah.
So I think I just want to make sure that everyone's aware that it came to quell a problem of all the nations trying to trade and it being almost impossible or very challenging to do so.
Does anyone else have anything to add to that? Thank you.
It just strikes me that my reaction to the WTO is negative, and I feel like, but wait a minute, you can't tell us what we can and can't do, and the us, I realize, is my nationalism rearing its head and saying, but we're a democratic country that we get to decide our own fate, you know, and now, based on economic terms, somebody else, somewhere else, is deciding what's going to happen based on economic grounds, not on democracy or our nationalist, our nation's method of making decisions. And it seems like it's the nationalism that this is bucking against, which makes sense in context of the beginning of what you're talking about.
Uh-huh.
But that it also would make sense that the environmental groups and labor groups and others who are looking for a more holistic view of the world and the use of our resources are railing against this too, because it's only strengthening the economism model or paradigm and not giving way to the earthism, which those groups I think would be in favor
for. Yeah. And these, I mean, what's your name again?
Glenn.
Kristen?
Glenn.
You're Glenn and you're
Kristen.
Kristen's comment about prior to GATT is an important one, because and one of the things that Cobb would celebrate about economism is that prior to economism, Christians were very concerned about nationalism as a real problem, and we saw that in World War II. And so the economism, in some ways, smoothed, created opportunities for the world to be more interdependent, to recognize our interdependency on one another, recognize the human community as intricately involved with one another. So he would celebrate that element of economism. And that's something that's part of what you're saying, Kristen, and partly what that country's, I'm not saying it's an absolute wrong that this thing has progressed how it has.
Well, it just seems that I don't think that nationalism has been supplanted at all. I think it's just that, you know, maybe we've changed guns for money, but I think nationalism is still a very strong power behind how a lot of decisions are made and why, you know, people stand where they are.
Well, I mean, Bob would agree with that nationalism is certainly not dead. But on the other hand, if a country's national laws can be challenged by a non-democratically elected body in Geneva, that's a significant shift for a country to make and be under.
But only if they participate in that.
Right. So is Cobb
agree to it?
Is Cobb saying that the WTO has authority over another country's, or over a country's political system, has authority?
No, I don't.
So we're kind of, that's,
I don't.
My sense is that WTOism has the same kind of authority that Christianism has, where it can influence political decisions and political systems, and have some, even maybe stronger influence over administrative kinds of procedures. But it doesn't.
I think it can, but I'm not. So you say it could affect the political system significantly if laws are sort of affected by this trans or ultra-national body separate from a country.
In a systematic
saying,
way.
I don't think you'd say it's controlling the political. And I think we need to shift. Dan, you look really anxious, so go ahead. So Dan was going to have a connection up here. So.
I think part of what's going on in terms of the nationalism question we're at now, I think there's also an element of kind of a sleight of hand process going on, which is I think what the labor organizations are concerned with, that you can talk about nationalism, but the economic reality is that nationalism isn't where the power is anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ford Motor Company and Chevrolet, we can all think on the folk level, is an American automobile, but the corporate leaders of those corporations are into economism, not nationalism. I mean, they're taking money and jobs away to wherever they want to go. And so we little people can be talking about nationalism, but the real powers, just like we don't know about the WTO, we also don't know where the real power is anymore, and what those decisions are, how they're affecting us and who's making them, and they are transnational.
One David Corton's book, When Corporations Rule the World, which came out a number of years ago, so this might have shifted, but 51 of the world's largest economies are corporations. 51 of the top 100. So you've got a lot of companies that have more economic weight and wealth than countries. 51 of the top 100 economies are corporations.
But to say that they're independently making decisions without political systems influencing them is a complete overstatement, in my opinion.
What's that?
I mean, the political systems in many countries still influences what those corporations can and cannot do. They do not, by themselves, make decisions that supersede laws in these countries. So Ford may choose to go a certain way and move jobs, but there are laws that influence them and control what they can and cannot do. So to say that they're ruling the world makes me uncomfortable.
That they're what?
They're controlling the world. They may have some. They have control over a portion of the economy, but that economy is not independent of the laws of
but,
the nations.
Yeah, but
they
on the
also help form the laws. But
sure.
And it's interesting to point out that while these corporations are the ones pushing for quote unquote free markets, right?
Mm-hmm.
Gives free markets. Mm-hmm. They operate internally. They're not necessarily a free market internally. They have very strict, you know, codes and rules about how they operate their economy. And they are an economy unto themselves now because they're so huge. They're larger than most countries. So they're asking for the rules that they're operating under internally are very different from the rules that they're pushing for externally. And I think we need to, I'd like to, go ahead.
Can you just give a quick illustration of that? I mean, I'm not knowing what you're talking about. Give an example of an internal rule.
Well, how much, how much wealth, how the wealth is distributed within a company, let's say, or how the That's a good question, because I'm not, does someone else have a good...
You might be saying that, like, Ford Motor Company's personnel rules as they're, as they play out in Guatemala, or, you know, example, their internal rules, and how they affect Guatemalan citizens without really any process by those citizens.
Anyone else have an example? Kristen, do you?
Well, I used to work for Microsoft, so it's a company a lot of people love to hate, but, but, you know, like, I have a colleague who is in Paris for Microsoft, and she has far better maternity leave vacation policies because she's working in France than we have here in the United States. So I don't know how true that is with different countries and different... In that example, I know that isn't always true.
Yeah.
I think one of the issues is the obverse of that, in which where a company can, and this is, of course, the labor point of view, is that, and the objection in NAFTA was that, unlike where Microsoft goes to France and wants, you know, the high-tech people and then has to meet the French vacation schedules and things like that, a multinational automobile company can go to Mexico and instead of abiding by the environmental rules of the United States, can take advantage of the fact that there are no environmental rules in Mexico, or the fact that because they have a mass capital and because payoffs are part of that culture, they can manipulate the laws to such an extent that they can then pollute the earth for pay. I mean, and then bring back cars cheaper than American laborers can make them, because they've been able to exploit the laborers in Mexico and be exploiting the environment, and therefore make even more profits in the United States. That's one of the ways that being a multinational and having enough capital, you can begin to manipulate the world on a global level. I also see some positives in globalization.
Yeah, well, and maybe we'll get to that soon, but what I want to do is shift to having some other perspectives from people who are... Anyway, I think Bob Ekblad might be willing to... Are you willing to maybe say something, Bob, about your experience working with migrant workers in terms of globalization's effects on their lives? Bob's one of the teachers here this week. And John McQuigg, is it? Is an apple grower in Wenatchee, so directly affected by globalization, increased globalization, Mark, and some good, some bad, probably. So I'd be interested to hear your experience, John. And then Lauren has been to Guatemala, right? And has a bit of a personal journey in relationship to his perspective around globalization that I thought would be interesting to hear a little bit about. So, and these are the three of us. I mean, I've had conversations with all these guys since Tuesday, and that's partly why we're doing this today slightly differently than what was planned. So, John, would you like to share a few
sure.
words?
As
an apple grower in Central Washington State, my perspective is probably a little different than a lot of other people's, in that we, as apple growers, are really just asking for a level playing field. We don't have a level playing field or even close to it. And we supported NAFTA because we thought NAFTA would bring a more level playing field in terms of approaching product into Mexico, product into Canada, you know, just covering the three countries that are covered under NAFTA. And in fact, that has worked that way. We had a problem with Mexico a couple years after NAFTA was passed. They wanted to protect their Red Delicious growers down there, so they slapped on a $5 a box tariff on the fruit coming in. And it lasted for 6 months, destroyed our market for that period of time, but we're at least able to get it taken out because it was onerous and was illegal under NAFTA. So it's been helpful. But the areas where the playing field really isn't level is in environmental laws. We have very restrictive environmental laws that restrict what we can put on the fruit, and there's so, you know, many, many chemicals have been taken away over the years. And if you go to Mexico, they're using all those chemicals, you know, and they can grow fruit much more cheaply as a result. On a world scale, I grow Granny Smith's, Red Delicious, Braeburn's, Gala's, Fuji's, and Rainier Cherries. And each of those crops, it's all supply and demand on those crops. So each crop is independently affected by the world market. For instance, the Grannies, we have a good early market in Grannies, and Granny prices have been pretty good. And then as soon as the South American fruit starts coming in, then our prices start dropping. So we've got to get ours moved before the South American fruit comes in, because they grow them so inexpensively in Chile. And so that's kind of interesting dynamic in the market there. The cherries, we've been able to get access to Japan, which has been a huge boon to the cherry growers. And 25% of the product from Washington goes to Japan as a result, which is a huge market. Now, on the apples, it took 25 years to get access into the market in Japan with apples, and they have such heavy restrictions on the fruit going in that there is no benefit to the market. There's very little fruit that gets shipped to Japan on the apple side.
It should be probably
10 to 15% of our market should be going there, products should be going there, but it's not. It's not because of the restrictions.
Now, isn't that contrary to the WTO and stuff?
You would certainly think so.
Can you challenge?
Yeah, you can.
Japan now?
Yeah, and that was a 25-year process to get that, to get it at least opened up that far. See, the difference between building widgets and growing agricultural products is that agricultural products could have bugs attached to it of some type. Okay, so that's the restriction that they bring up, and they keep bringing up these sort of phantom problems. And Japan is an interesting political spectrum, because their political system is organized like the Senate, in that a state like California would have as much influence as a state like Oregon. Okay, like there's two senators for each area that you come from. So the farmers have huge control over the political system there. It's not based on population. And so in that case, they just shut us off. Anything that they grow in Japan, they will find a way to shut us off. And actually in cherries, it used to be that you couldn't go in until their cherries were actually marketed. And then you'd open up about the 1st of July, the market in Japan would open up. Well, after some of these challenges and so forth, it now has opened up much wider. But they can sort of raise these phantom issues that take years and lots of money to deal with, mm-hmm. to try and overcome them. Because it's not like selling T-shirts or something. You know, you have to worry about what's attached to it.
Do the New Zealanders have the same restrictions that we have, and that, or are they more like Mexico?
New Zealand, we don't ship much product to New Zealand. They ship a lot in here.
Oh, right.
They ship a lot of Galas in here, and that's primarily what comes in from New Zealand. And I don't know the reason that we don't ship much product there. We haven't opened those markets up. It's very expensive to open up a foreign market. It takes a company to do it. It takes a fruit packer to do it, to really open up a market. So it's not easy.
So who's involved in those negotiations?
Excuse me, I thought what we do is maybe have these two other guys say a little bit. You can stay up here if you want, or have a seat and come back up in a minute. But thank you very much, Tom. Let's kind of keep your questions in mind and hear a couple other stories, perspectives here. You can either do it from your seat or come on up, whatever you want to do. Bob?
I'm not a farmer, but
tell a little bit about who you work with.
I'm a pastor working with farm workers in Western Washington, in north of Seattle an hour, in the Skagit Valley. And we, a lot of the growers there produce roast strawberries, and that's the main draw for the farm workers. That's where they can usually make the most amount of money. And so people come up from California, they come from Eastern Washington, they come from Texas, they come from Mexico. And we have thousands and thousands of migrants that come in. There's like 9, 10 migrant labor camps in our county that they'll flood into. And usually the harvest starts around like mid-June. Well, this year, two processing plants in Oregon folded and went under, strawberry processing plants, which was, as I think, resulted because Mexico and also California strawberries are a lot less expensive. I mean, the Northwest strawberry, from what I understand, I've experienced it, is the most delicious sort of variety. And but there's only a 20-day harvest period, mm-hmm. and so it's and that's a very fragile crop. And it's anyway, because of that, it's more expensive. And anyway, a lot of big multinationals are preferring to cut costs by buying strawberries, less expensive strawberries from California, but especially from Mexico and China now. And that has that's made it very, very difficult for growers in the Northwest to be able to find a market for them. I mean, they can't even sell their products. So many, many growers in Oregon just they dissed under their strawberry plants or let them rot in the fields. And so farm workers, there were all these farm workers that came for their normal work in Oregon. And instead of stopping in Oregon, all the migrant camps, where a lot of them were closed, they just moved up into Washington. So Washington just had we have an abundance of farm workers in our county. And what that did was, that's great for growers. Mm-hmm. And so they had bigger crews, and then they made some stronger requirements, like there's a minimum wage laws in Washington are the highest, or second highest, I think, in the country, 672 or something. And there's a law that growers are required to supplement people's what they make, piecework or by the pound, so that they're at least making $6.72 an hour. Well, the way with a huge labor force, what they're able to do is tell the people, well, we want to see you picking so many pounds per day minimum. And so they check, and they do checks like every other day or twice a week, to see who is, isn't measuring up to that standard. And that standard would basically cover the cost of minimum wage, right? So a lot of people have been fired. And since there's so many farm workers, there's always someone to take the job. What that's done is it's made everyone anxious. So people are picking faster. And since they have bigger crews, the harvest happened in 14 days instead of 20 days. And people were only working 3 hours a day instead of 8 hours a day. Mm-hmm. So the farm workers were all saying, hey, we're getting out of here. We're not ever coming back. But of course, where are they going to go? And I mean, a lot of them are heading back to California for the grape harvest now. But I mean, that's because some of the farmers did that, that was good for them, because they were able to pick their fields clean. And they have more, strawberries sort of in cold storage right now than they've had in years. But the consequences are going to be maybe felt next year when not enough farm workers come north. So anyway, that's because of China and the competition from China and Mexico. But then there's the raspberry harvest too. In the past, raspberries were all hand harvested, but now it's almost all machine harvest, and that's because of what's happened in Bosnia. Well, Bosnia actually helped. The war in Bosnia was a great boom for Northwest raspberry growers, because they were the main producers of raspberries. And so when the war was happening and countries weren't, there was a lot less production, but then also there was an embargo, against Bosnia. So a lot of the strawberries, that was great for the U.S. But in Chile, the Chileans, growers, they flooded the European market and actually took over the European market. So that hurt Northwest growers. So anyways, Northwest growers have been almost mechanizing everything. Everything's machine harvest. And so there's no more work for farm workers to pick raspberries. Well, that's a big problem for the growers, because they need to be able to keep the farm workers busy until the cucumber harvest, which starts in August, right? So I mean, it's just a huge, complicated mess. And so anyway, now Chile is now Bosnia is back in the picture, because the war is over and the embargo has been lifted. So Chile, the Europeans are buying from Bosnia. Well, Chile is just dumped, or is being accused right now of just dumping raspberries on the U.S. market, which is just making raspberry growers, they're not making a thing this year. So growers in the Northwest aren't making anything. They're losing money on strawberries and on raspberries. And a lot of them are ready to just go under. I mean, the people going under every year in our county, in Skagit County, going bankrupt.
Thank you, Bob. Let's hear, Lauren, you want to tell your story a little bit for a few minutes?
Okay.
I'm not here as an expert. I'm more talking as a person who, in a sense, has gone through, those Abbott Costello movies where the guy, Abbott leans against the wall and the wall spins around and he goes into another room and what's on the other side is the raging gorilla that's looking for him. And then the thing spins around. Well, in my case, I leaned against the wall, I spun around, but there was no spinning back. And I kind of rocked into another reality. What I want to try to do is just give you a sense of, I'm sensing what there are other people going to South or Central America have gone through the same process. I've talked to a couple of people up here, and I'm guessing that there's more. But before I left, I used to think in terms of the rich and poor gap as this line where we live up here. But this line would be moving down like this. And that I was a firm believer in, relatively firm believer in world trade, capitalism, and the buzzwords of the creative destruction of the market, how when capital is unfettered, yes, there are dislocations, but then those dislocations lead to the more efficient use of capital, and that is the great wealth creation engine of capitalism. And didn't entirely buy it. I had reservations, but it basically, I thought the thing fit. It basically was working. I went to Nicaragua a year and a half ago, and I began to see the world another way. But I went again in January and February, and actually John and I were on the same mission trip. We were working in a rural Nicaraguan village, and what happened was I started to spend a lot of time while I was hauling dirt around. Just my mind was busy, and I was just watching people haul wood. I was watching the kids haul wood and people working. I watched kids pick our coffee beans, and I found myself. That's when I had what I would call an aha, where I went, wait a minute. What I thought was happening is the worldview of someone who adopts a convenient view. It's very easy to adopt. And from someone who lives up here. And I came to another realization, at least it's what I would call a realization, in which this is actually a very fixed barrier. It's been fixed for a long time. It's been fixed for hundreds of years. And the things that we have in place, no matter how we talk in terms of development, this is a fixed. This is a fixed system. In terms of the world, how I began to, I came back home pretty much shattered, and I just turned into a hermit and began reading all kinds of books. One of them was When Corporations Rule the World. Before I left, I would have looked at corporations, anybody reading corporations viewing the world as a kook. And all of a sudden, I had to say, well, I'm a kook now. And I think the point isn't why, I'm not here to say, all right, people, you need to believe this way. What I'm here to talk about is to use what I went through as a kind of a case study for and stop me if I'm going on too long, but the conversation we had was around the fact that basically many people who come to Holden Village come already in one of the other camps. And it's kind of the opinions that are held by these two ways of looking at the world, and there's probably other models as well, is almost held at the level of a religion. This is it's a worldview. I believe it. If you're over here, you're part of a good world. You're part of a good world in which you're helping others by gradually over time. Yes, there's some bumps in the road, but we're going to be helping people. Over here, it's a vastly different kind of world. But we come here, I think many of us, in roughly one camp or the other. Then we come here to seminar, we hear some buzzwords. I wrote one down, it is a sin to degrade the earth. If I'm a conservative person over here, I'm going to go, grr, this guy's a tree hugger. You know, look people, the earth is a resource. When we use it in the sense that it was meant to be used, it helps people, it feeds families. And we just can't be living in these unrealistic ways of looking at things. And what do? I walk out the back door, probably not having said anything, but I walk out kind of angry. I say, tomorrow I'm going to go for a hike. I'm not going to be coming back to this place. I think the issue was is how, and this was our conversation, was how, if this model is true, that people are living and holding these opinions at the level of a kind of a religious worldview, how is it that these two worlds can talk to each other intelligibly? Now, for me, what I view is that before I had one hand on an elephant. You know, that whole thing, the elephant is, you have the tail, the elephant's a rope, the elephant's a snake, or the elephant's a tree trunk, or the elephant's a wall. Well, I'm still a person with a blindfold on, even though I think I've seen the light. But I have to confess, I know I'm still a person with a blindfold on. I can shift it over to another part of the elephant. I still remember the first part of the elephant that I was feeling. But I'm saying, no, I got a different view of what this sucker is, and now I think I really know what it is. But what's happened? I'm still fairly ignorant. And I think that's where I'll stop. I think that was the gist of our conversation. And I have a tremendous hunger to know the truth. It's kind of like, what is the truth? I really fear that what I believe and came to see is the truth. I would rather not believe that because it's too horrible.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe the nature of your experience? What actually happened that caused this aha?
Sure. I think
I'll try to give you a brief answer. In the sense of when I saw, I think it was the sense of watching people. Struggle to get rice and beans. And living in a world in which their world is as far as they can walk, or if they have a little bit of money they can get on a bus, or they can hitch a ride down the road. But basically they will live and die in that world. I began to ask myself, how is that possible? And then I just went, wait a minute. There was such a thing as an invasion of these people by Europeans. And then it just kind of went from there where I began to logically put blocks together. And in the sense that regimes were put in place, power structures were put in place, young capitalism grew up parallel to a colonial system. And power relationships were established, which still exist today. And it was in that sense where I began to view myself as living in a very, very privileged world, and that these people were working extremely hard for things that I take for granted. Mm-hmm. I want a cup of coffee. Yeah. I could use a banana now. Mm-hmm. And what? Guess what? It's trivial. If I don't have my coffee today, my life doesn't change. It's like, man, if you get in the jitters. But on the other hand, these people, their whole life, the very fact that they're going to get food depends on the price of coffee, which, by the way, has collapsed. And the story that I heard, one of the reasons is the World Bank decided to fund a lot of coffee in Vietnam, and it's destabilized the market, plus some other factors like weather in Brazil. And so I think it was just watching people and realizing that I am, their work, they're making life really, really, really good for me. And it was shattering. I probably came home and cried for weeks.
What made you the most sad, looking at your life or looking at their life?
After I've been back in the United States, it's not as sad anymore. It's a real sucker of your soul. It is sad. And at times when I drop back into the room again, I cry again. I think it's both, because they're both there. Well, I'm going to stop and let you go.
Thanks very much, you guys. I think what's really powerful is the telling of our own stories and in relationship to this stuff. And what often is transformative is a willingness to go and expose oneself to the quote-unquote the other. I mean, that's the conversion experience, in a sense, that Lauren is talking about. I know in my own experience that's often been what has helped transform me, is being in relationship, quote-unquote, with the other or something or someone that somehow breaks through and I see things through different eyes. And what allows us to do that often is a willingness to be, in your case, going to Honduras, was it?
Nicaragua and Guatemala.
In Guatemala.
I was in Guatemala for several weeks.
Yeah. And to go and to hear the stories of John's Apple business and how it is that he sees and is able to survive or not in this global economy. And the stories, I mean, they're so complex. And I both like, oh, you know, when you're going from Bosnia to Chile and then Chile to Mexico and Mexico to China. And that is where we are now in this world. And the one thing that comes to mind also when you were talking, Lauren, is how this, as you put it, there's this barrier that's just there, and how that barrier perceives any person or place in the world as a potential place to make money, as resource. I mean, yesterday on Tuesday we talked a bit about that, the circle of nature's economy and the line of the human economy, and how the line of the human economy at one end looks at capital, labor, and resources, and that's what we see, and it in a sense forces all that stuff at this end of the line to be seen as a resource. Labor is a resource. Well, labor is people. You know, resources are resources. Well, resources are trees and streams and fish that support life in an ecosystem. So it's a worldview, it's an economy that in a sense forces us to see everything as resource. And what I see in that is that it desacralizes the world, and that we have a faith that doesn't jive with that. I don't think our faith
sees everything as resource or supports that worldview. Now, when we get to all these specific stories, I have no idea how to weed them out and come to conclusions about what's the right thing to do. It's hard for any of us to know that, and to know, as Lauren says, what is the truth here. But for me, that's the framework that I'm looking at it through, is this world as resource, world as desacralized place for exploitation. And not to demonize corporations or corporate people. We are all corporate people in one way or another. We benefit from it. Many of us work for corporations. I'm wearing clothes from, this could well be from China. Although my brother-in-law never buys anything from China. I'm trying to emulate it. But it's probably from Malaysia, not China. I mean, so it's I think maybe
6:05.
I'd like to give Bob and John any response to Lauren, maybe giving responses to Lauren's story from your own experience before we need to head to dinner.
Well, I lived part of Lauren's story with him because I went on two of those mission trips with him, and I had very similar reactions. My eyes really were opened dramatically in meeting those people, living with them, sort of understanding their struggle, working with them. It really opened my eyes that I before I went down there, I thought that I always work out the bootstrap theory. If you work hard enough, you can pull yourself up by your bootstraps, no problem. They have absolutely no opportunity. They have none whatsoever. Even if they get education, if they are not among the political elite, they can't get a job. They're just going to be, competing for those rice and beans. In addition, the populations are growing dramatically, so that if you're living in the same area that used to support 2,500 people, now has to support 25,000 people. What happens in that race for resources? It's just a huge problem. So I concur 100%. Really, it really opened my eyes. Last year, Cynthia Moldavida, who was a speaker here, I don't think any of you heard her, but she started off every session with saying that there are children starving in third world countries in the world because of our consumerism, because of how we consume. And that came home very dramatically that was true. We're in this global race for resources. They can't get at them because they don't have the political or ability or the money to purchase them. They can't even get on the system, let alone move up the ladder. And so they're just completely left out.
Yeah, my wife Gracie and I, we lived in Honduras for 6 years in the 80s, and have gone back every year since then for a couple weeks, and have a ministry, a program down there that we're in contact or we support. And it's been amazing to watch. Our whole objective there was to help people stay on the land and avoid migrating to the big city and then off to North America. And we taught sustainable farming and organic farming, organic intensive farming. And there's about 15 agricultural promoters and health workers that maintain that program now. But they say that it's so hard to get any of the farmers to work with them now because they can't subsist. I mean, they can't sell their corn. You know, now the markets have been opened, and so a lot of corn comes from El Salvador. You know, the U.S. dumps grain on Central America, too, and that lowers the prices, so they can't sell. You know, and to have a subsistence mentality is, to really subsist, that involves a lot of hard work and sacrifice. And what we've seen happen is just massive numbers of, we're seeing a huge exodus from Honduras and Central America to North America. Sure. And I get calls, collect calls all the time from people in Guatemala, in Mexico, in Tijuana along the border, asking me, is there any way you could wire me $1,500 to pay the coyote? Mm-hmm. I get calls very often like that. And but then on the other hand, there's this whole this drug trafficking thing. There's a lot of folks that just say, hey, you know, we're not waiting for Habitat for Humanity or the ELCA or the Presbyterian Church or WTO protesters. I mean, forget them. You know, we know how to make it to North America. And, you know, like our village right next to where we worked and where we used to work, almost all the young people got involved and they found out they could make big money selling crack in Portland until the Portland police cracked down on them and they moved to Vancouver. Well, the main drug dealers in the streets of Vancouver are Honduran peasants from the villages where we worked. And there's a whole way, I mean, you know, anyone who wants to get up and sell drugs, they can get their way paid, you know, and the people that are paying them aren't high level folks. They're like peasants who sort of made it big in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And now they've got this program. So, you know, I mean, a lot of money's going back down to the village, you know, from selling drugs, selling cocaine and heroin. It's amazing. So in some ways, I think if you want to help the peasants, you know, start using drugs.
That would be a great closing line. I concluded. Yeah. But I'm not going to give you the last line. You've had your hand up.
I was just, what do you do? I mean, I guess that's probably an open-ended question, but I mean, as a nobody, it's like, okay, there's all these problems, and...
What do you do?
Yeah.
Well, that's, I mean, partly my responses to Lauren were along those lines of open oneself up to being transformed by being in relationship with people and places that are strongly under the thumb of how things are going now. That's a thing. One, it's not a doing, it's almost just a being, a going and being. And then, so there's that, and that points to, you know, very much a change of heart to day one. Monday we're talking about a call to conversion, that in order to really live in a different way and begin to address these kinds of issues, we need to continually be open to being transformed by the love of God. But there's specifics. There are specific choices we make in our daily lives, our consumer habits, where we can make small differences. If all of us make small differences, it is a big difference. There's that reality. And there's also then this political shift that can happen. For example, I talked briefly about gross domestic product versus as one way to measure economic wealth. If our country got behind a different way of measuring economic wealth, it would significantly shift our economic system. For example, there's a group in California, I'll just summarize this briefly for those who haven't already, that's developing the Genuine Progress Indicator. Mm-hmm. They take out things that we don't want in from the GDP. The GDP includes things like an Exxon Valdez oil spill. That ups the GDP. Divorce ups the GDP because you have one household becoming two, you got two sets of furniture, you've got lawyers' fees. The GDP is simply a measure of the exchange of money, exchange of goods and services. So the GPI, genuine progress, that's kind of a nice term, genuine progress, would subtract for an Exxon Valdez oil spill, or basically subtract ecological and social costs. Subtract for divorce, add in for volunteer work, add in for work done in the home. I mean, that's not valued in our current economic system because money doesn't change hands. So, and the punchline is that the GPI, Genuine Progress Indicator, has gone down since 1972 consistently, where GDP continues to go up. So, a political movement, you could, maybe if you're psyched about that, you could become part of the folks that push for GPI. So there are political shifts that need to happen as well as individual shifts. And one of the ways that I think both are motivated is by being open to being in relationship with people and places that are oppressed. So. And then
I just want to say something about the complexity thing is that sure, everything is totally complex, but that's also a tool of the corporations and the governments and everything. I mean, everybody who's ever been in any kind of left-wing movement has been accused of being naive and you don't understand and the complexity and blah, blah, blah. And it's all true, but at the same time, and I used to think that people were just apathetic and that they didn't care about anything but their own families. And now, I mean, the older I get, the more I realize that a lot of people are really concerned about this stuff, but they just feel like, yeah, I'm too small, it's too complex, you know, it's all I can do just to pay my own bills and get school, you know, clothes for my kids. And that seems to me to be the real issue, is how do you act even though it's complex and even though it seems like you're a tiny
Thank you, that's very important.
I just really liked Lauren's comment, or how he pointed out if somebody who subscribed to the other point of view was in the session, they would just walk out and take a hike and not come back. And I liked how we said we need to open ourselves up to the conversion experience, but of both groups, I think we can't just separate ourselves into groups of people who think like us. We have to keep making our community as large as possible to include those in the power elite or conservative.
Yeah, I would say in order to do that, in order to enter in dialogue, I have to say I'm willing to open myself up to these arguments and be willing to become vulnerable to them.
Yeah.
And to listen to them rationally. And it's the same for both. Rather than the point counterpoint type of thing, like, hey, you want to go live in a gulag? You go right ahead.
Would someone like to close us in prayer before we go for dinner? That would be a good thing to do.
Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for the opportunity to discuss these issues. We ask that you might enlighten us and help us to seek the truth as we live in community with our neighbors. In Jesus' holy name. Amen.